What do they want?
They've come here to see me.
My name is Jamie Roberts.
And I'm Robert Lendrum.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the films that had you running away, but coming back for more. Jamie, we're back for another one. Nice to see you, buddy. We haven't talked in a bit.
It's been a while. It's just, you know what? Summer. I would say this is a summer of discontent, but this has been the summer of content because everybody has been able to go back out and do things and see people, and it's been fantastic. Everybody I talk to has had a very busy summer. I know you've had a busy summer with your move to Montreal.
Yeah.
We've had a busy summer just seeing a lot of people that we haven't seen in a couple of years. So yeah, you know what I mean? We're trying to pump out the jams. It's just taking a little bit longer than we thought, but we're here today and I'm excited. We got a great film.
Yeah, so today, this is something you pulled, right?
This is something I pulled. Yeah, this is something that I pulled. Actually, when I did a poll in terms of what we were going to do for our next movie, this one came in dead last. But then I was thinking about it. Darren Aronofsky, the director of this film, is someone who I admire, somebody I think makes good stuff, good films. So what I did is I just put out a picture of Mother. That's the film we're doing tonight. And it got a ton of comments. And I found that it was really polarizing. So I thought, you know, I sent you a message. I said, let's bang in on this one. This one looks like it's got some interest out in the masses. So let's do it. And so, boy, did we ever do it.
You tell me that this got like dead last in our poll, and yet this is the one we're doing? We're ignoring the people on this one.
Rob, that's the beauty of our podcast. We can do what we want. No, we were going to do The Black Phone. And then I remember sending you a message saying, hey, Mother looks like it's got a little bit of an interest from this tweet that I sent out. This looks interesting. Let's do this film. So we did this film.
Yeah, and I was interested too. This is something I didn't know a lot about, but like had heard about it and thought, wow, I heard it's polarizing. I heard it's a difficult film, but not difficult in the sense of like, I don't know what to make of it. More difficult, like it is a viewing experience unlike many other films. So we are going to get into that. But a couple things to plug before we get started. For those of you who are not in Canada, you might not know the name Terry Fox, but he is like a national icon in Canada. This guy tried to run across the country with a artificial leg because he got cancer. He lost his leg. So he started trying to raise money for it. And he started this whole national movement. He eventually did die because of cancer, but his name lives on in this foundation. And they have done incredible work raising over, I think it's $800 million worldwide. They're one of those charities where a high percentage of their money that they raise goes right back into cancer research. So they're a pretty good charity, and I'm going to help out this year, as a lot of people at my work do. We're trying to raise some money for Terry Fox. So if it's a run, it's like a 5-kilometer run. So I'm going to do a little. I'm going to try to push myself to 5K, Jamie. I know you're laughing, but for me that's a big deal. I'm going to throw on a jog cast and push myself. Yeah, man. So anyway, if you got even like 5 ducats, 10 bucks, whatever you got, I would totally appreciate you helping me raise money for this. It's on our Twitter. You can find it on my Twitter as well. And Jamie's going to give a huge donation, right, James?
That's right. I haven't done that yet. I feel like I need to donate to my partner. So don't worry about it. Don't worry about all the people out there if you haven't donated yet. I haven't either. But I'm going to support my partner because that's what I do. We're a partnership here at Running Scared, and this is for a great cause. That's great, Rob. I'm glad you're doing that. We're also doing something else, or we had just completed something else. Rob, we just finished the new Jogcast, Insulum Creatura, and it's going really well. People are downloading it. People are sending us messages. People are really enjoying the new format where the runner is actually yourself and you're centered in the story. So that's been really fantastic. If you haven't got a chance to check that out, we have a preview right now that's up on the main feed. You'll just see that Insulum Creatura preview. It's about 14 to 15 minutes of the story. The remaining part of the story you can actually access on our Patreon. If you go to Running Scared, the Patreon is right there, or you can access and purchase the full story at any audiobook retailer, Rakuten, Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google Play. It's all there for you.
And better yet, if you want to support us, go to Patreon, where we have changed our levels and kind of, you know, really focused to make it a little easier for everyone. We now have 3 tiers that are like lower entry points for everyone. And at the second tier, you get two Jodcasts. At the third tier, you get all three Jodcasts. That is a good tier. It's $5 a month. And then there is still the slasher mode, which is like the full on, like you're totally just here to help us and we love you. All three Jodcasts plus any future ones that we create. And we are always working on these. So, and you can also find a free Jodcast of Helen Hamilton available there. So if you go to our Patreon at patreon.com/runningscared, you can find the free Helen Hamilton. You can find the preview of Insulum Creatura. And if you sign up for one of our tiers, take a look at what each give you. But the highest tier or the third tier at $5 a month gives you all three Jodcasts, which is a better way to support us, frankly, than the bookstores. Not that we don't love the bookstores, but there's a few people taking cuts of the payment there. That's all our plugs, Jamie. Let's get deep diving here into Mother. And let's start off with our one-line challenge.
Absolutely. Here we go. Rob, are you going? I think I actually went first last time, and then it
no,
was
I went
you,
first.
And then it
I went first.
Ari.
And chopping my volunteer because you tried to throw Ari under the bus and make him go first, and then he came back and killed us because he had an awesome way of doing the one line challenge.
Oh yeah, yeah, he's like way better. We should just bring him in for the one line challenge and then send him on his way. But exactly, what's up, Ari Fleeman? Thanks for coming on Chopping Mouth. Okay,
I'm ready. I'm going to count you in. 3, 2, 1.
Mother. A couple out in a very ambiguous and isolated house embark on an intense, terrifying journey through and within their ideas and understanding of life, existence, and the world itself. Mother.
That was so vague. You could have been talking about any movie.
I actually thought it was pretty good. I purposely didn't think about it. And then what I'm doing now is when I do the one line challenge, I'm closing my eyes and I'm using a visualization technique. So I'm trying. We'll see if that actually sounds better in the final edit. Rob, you're in. 3, 2, 1.
When an episode Mother. I gotta do this. I don't know why we do chop and tail. It's so weird. Fucking... Mother.
Bookends. It's for dramatic.
When a Mike Holmes fan tries to rebuild her family home, but finds it difficult when her partner is not participating, things go off the rails when he keeps inviting everyone over and they keep trashing her fucking house. Finally, resulting in a complete meltdown of not just her world and her life, but all of society. Mother.
Okay, so you know what? You tried to drop in a joke at the beginning, the old Mike Holmes joke, and that kind of put you off the rails. But then you kind of brought it back together, you know, dropping a swear word, swear counts up. This movie...
Do non-Canadians know who Mike Holmes is, or is that a Canadian reference?
It's got to be a Canadian reference.
So he's like one of those home building guys.
I don't think Mike Holmes is a household name, just like Brian Balmer. I don't think he's a household name down in the States. So anyways, I thought you did a pretty good job, but here's the thing with this film. You don't go into this film with a very sort of classic traditional structure of a movie. It's sort of all over the place. It's a little bit different. It really reminds me of, well, and it should, a lot of his other films. And I remember watching one of his first films, if not his first film. Rob, do you remember Requiem for a Dream?
And that was, my God.
Yeah.
Of course. This was like every film student's favorite movie back in whatever year it was, 2001.
2000 it was released.
Yeah.
This guy's only made like 6 or 7 movies, right?
Yeah. And that movie was like, yeah, it was hammered into our head. It had that really interesting way of shooting and editing style where they cut into like the eyeball and then there'd be like this flash of cuts.
Yeah.
And you'd watch the eyeball pupil expand and all that shit. There was some really interesting visual techniques as well as, but it was also like a very depressing story, right? I think it ends bad for everyone.
It was.
Spoiler.
Yeah. Well, it's old. I think we can have the spoilers there. It's interesting. All of his movies, they generally run on this like linear continuum that just descends into darkness. You know, in other films, you sort of got like, you know, these triggering actions and climax. What is that, Rob, when it's just, it's like you're getting on, we talked about this, you get on a ride and the ride just sort of takes you all into the, it's very, I don't want to say straightforward because that's not what I'm after here, but it's just, one long journey into depression, darkness, death, intensity. Like, what is that?
I don't know, man. That's the opposite of what Hollywood is after, right? And I think that's why people are interested in what he's doing, because he isn't willing to play the ball game. He makes really high quality, beautiful films that don't play by the rules, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is another one of those. This is another like intense experience. And that's why as a filmmaker, I think he's really interesting, because, you know, he's not making movies. He's making experiences that like
great point.
Challenge you to like sit through it, bear with it, deal with it. And there's times that you really enjoy it, and there's times where it's frankly hard, like really hard to watch and unbearable at times. Before we get started, Jamie, there's one PSA I want to put out to anyone who hasn't yet watched this film. I assume you've watched it if you're tuning in, because we always do spoilers here, as you all should know. But if you haven't watched it yet and you're kind of like, you know, listening to this to wade the waters before you get into it, don't do drugs before you watch this movie.
This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Like, do not get high. I don't care. I mean, maybe if you're not a paranoid type, you'll be fine. But if you are, holy shit, man, this movie's about to fuck you up. This movie is so much. There's so much anxiety in this film.
You wrote this, and then I immediately put in afterwards, I watched this on a gummy.
No,
little
no.
Indica.
So how did you do?
It, you know what, that's kind of like a lowbrow body buzz kind of high. So it allowed me to still stay sort of mentally centered into what was going on. But it definitely intensified the experience when you get to, it's really, there's like the chaotic last like 45 minutes out. Like just like it's an absolute insane. Yeah. Like I was like very. Yeah.
The roller coaster kicks in hard.
It does. I was very stimulated. Very stimulated, and it was helping me with that, but not in so much of a claustrophobic feel. I don't know if you felt that when you were watching it, but just like an intense, my eyes were wide open and all of my senses were heightened. So not only can you feel what certain things would feel like in the film, you can smell, you can taste. There's, you know, they do a very, very good job of making this a visceral picture, which just when you're on an indica little gummy, it just absolutely intensifies and just makes the experience all that more enjoyable. So definitely, like, it didn't go too crazy, but it made it a little bit of a stronger experience.
So you mentioned the back half of the movie, the last 45 minutes where things really start to escalate and there's a lot of, you know, like literally like a war zone is happening at one point. It's really overwhelming. Yeah. Physically, and you're running from room to room and things are falling apart and there's people fighting and there's blood and it's like there's no sense of how it happened, so you're very confused. I actually felt, for me, it was the first 45 minutes that really heightened my anxiety. Like, so I don't know about you, but did you ever used to have anxiety dreams? Because as a teenager and onward in life, I often had these really, I don't know if lucid's the word, because lucid's like when you have full control more so, isn't it? But I would have these dreams that were very realistic to me, but were all anxiety based. And what would happen is I would be like sleeping in my bed and I would be like absolutely sure that there was like a party happening around me and that all these people were in my room and I was at the party. But then I was also very self-conscious of the fact that I was in bed with like probably just wearing my underwear and being like, oh shit, I can't get out of bed and walk around the party in my underwear. Like I look like a weirdo. Like, and I would be consumed with this and would like circle in my mind all night long. I'd have these really intense like anxiety dreams. That's what this film felt like to me, especially in these first 45 minutes where Jennifer Lawrence cannot figure out who these people are coming to her house, why they're there, why her husband keeps inviting them, why they feel like they own the place. And she's constantly kind of cleaning up after them and following them around and be like, what are you doing now? Like, why do you keep fucking up my shit? Like, and criticizing her space and her life. And like, it's just like super hard to feel positive about anything in that early half of the film.
Absolutely. To speak to the point about how she feels this anxiety, I almost think that when she's in the early scenes, like she's looking outside, it almost feels like she doesn't know who's coming into her home later on, but she almost doesn't even know like where she is. Even though they allude that she's there just to fix the house, she's got a very kind of like laser focus as to what she's doing. But there's one shot. She walks outside and she looks at the outside landscape. Like there's no roads. She's looking at it like she's looking at it for the first time, which makes me nervous. Like, oh my God, she doesn't even know what she's doing here. I think she understands her purpose, but as she's being clouded by a whole bunch of other things.
I thought she might be agoraphobic. Like she is afraid to go outside, and that maybe the movie was going to be about her never leaving.
Well, there's just these certain scenes where her facial expressions, you know, do a really good job of opening up a window into her character. I think she does an admirable job in her performance. When you talked about anxiety dreams, it's funny, like I never had anxiety dreams with party stuff. I always had an anxiety dream with, because I went back to school later on in life and I was doing my university, you know, in my mid-20s, I would have this like waking dream where I was old, but I was like back in grade 8 and I was I was failing. Like I was not able to like, you know, I missed a credit or I missed something. And then I had planned to go on to the next one, but I like in the dream, I didn't achieve the credit. So then I had to go back. And so the anxiety came from just having to repeat and having to sort of restart. It was like one of those like rabbit hole where you kind of have to restart back from the beginning again, like a snakes and ladders. It gave me, honestly, Rob, it gave me anxiety for years because, you know, fucking around in my 20s and then not getting shit together until my 30s, I still have that big time insecurity and anxiety about that. But in terms of, so in that sense, I definitely like that uncertainty or that inability to control things around you. That definitely drives anxiety to me when you feel like you can't control it.
Well, and that's the thing about this film. That's exactly her character. She has zero control about anything that's happening. And every time she tries to assert control, it's taken away again. And it takes a while before you recognize like, or are able to, there's a weird point in the film where you have to kind of buy in and just be like, okay, I'm just going to let this movie take me for a while, because it's not like a typical horror or even like a standard narrative film.
Great point.
You're entering like a whole new world where the rules of story and narrative don't really apply. And so you have to kind of like let it take you, because very quickly you realize, okay, things are not as it seems. Like there's a real strength to the film. There's a certain point where you realize that, and you just have to kind of hang on and you go on this very strange and kind of terrifying roller coaster ride. And like you said, it didn't really kick in. The roller coaster ride didn't really kick in until a little later. But there's still a mental anxiety roller coaster that's happening, where every time she seems to have something stabilized, it gets unstabilized immediately. So it's not like a standard horror where you're fearing death or torture or pain. It's more like you fear that your entire understanding of like reality has been wrong all along. The hard part about this film. It's like really messing with your head, because you're like, oh man, like I don't know what the rules of this space are. And it's very like I'm unhinged. Like I start to feel like I'm lost, but in a way that's like fearful and fun a little bit, if you let it take you, rather than like completely like, oh my God, what's this film doing? I don't get it. Like, don't worry about what the film's doing. Just go. Just let it go with, like, take it, let it take you with you.
Yeah. It's one thing that I think I might mention in the review and the critique is, you're right, it's not a standard narrative. It's not a standard horror film. What I found as I watched this movie with a critical eye is often it reminded me of like a mixed media piece of work where you have like paper and then oil and then watercolor. And I kind of, those are like a metaphor for the different themes that are used in this film, which are sort of layered on top of each other and spliced together. It makes for an interesting work when you actually take a step back and look at it. But when you try to piece together, like you just said, a standard narrative or a standard story, it becomes increasingly difficult because it's so filled and it's so theme-based. It's so metaphor-based. You know, does this movie, before we get into the character, does it come across as sort of arrogant filmmaking, that it just is so chocked filled with metaphors and symbolism and theme that, you know, I don't want to say like it challenges the the podcaster who's making a film review or a film critic, right? is this film accessible for, I don't want to say the layman, but is are movies like this accessible for someone who's not making like a hobby out of reviewing films like this? What do you think? Should we critique the director?
It's hard because, like I said, to me, I think what's interesting about the director is he's challenging you to kind of question what is a movie. Like, I think most of us go in thinking it's going to be a story and it's going to be chapter one, chapter two. And because he's blowing that out of the way and it's like really forcing you to just be like, this thing is just pulling me into this black hole of like craziness. What do I think about that? Is this an experience I want to take part in? Do I enjoy it? And even if I didn't enjoy it, did I get something out of it? I think one of the questions people are having is, you know, all this layering of metaphor and symbols, does it actually add up to anything? A lot of people are, I think, are struggling to like, you know, well, is this a biblical allegory of, you know, because we looked at it that way too. Like we first thought, okay, maybe mother is maybe Mother Earth and maybe he, the husband, is maybe God, maybe the devil. Maybe Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer are like, you know, Adam and Eve and their kids are Cain and Abel because one of them kills the other one. But then there's times where like that metaphor doesn't connect and doesn't hold together. There's definitely other points where it does. And then, you know, so it is a struggle because like I feel like he's almost forcing you to try to let go of your, you know, instinct to apply an easy narrative that you've heard before and make it all click and work and layer it on top of what you're seeing. Because at times it just isn't there. Or like if it is, it's hard to read. And I don't think he's trying to do just a retelling of like, you know, the story of Adam and Eve or whatever.
Yeah, no. I agree. So that's kind of a little front matter look here. Rob, let's take a look at some of the characters specifically in the film, performances, what they bring to the movie. Start off with Jennifer Lawrence. And one of the things in this film is nobody has a name. So she's referred to as Mother in this film.
But does anyone call her that, or that's just what it says in the credits?
That's just what it says in the credits. That's just what it says in the subtitle.
Yeah, it's tricky because in the film, she is trying to rebuild a house, right? And this is a house that he used to live in, and it burned down. And now they're trying to rebuild it. And I don't think she's trying to make it exactly like it was, but she's trying to make it a home again. In fact, I think she even says at one point, it's my paradise.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise.
But after a while, like, you realize you don't, like, she's a dedicated wife and she loves her husband. She even tries to, like, arouse him unsuccessfully. You know, she's trying to keep the magic alive, but their marriage is definitely falling apart. He seems disinterested and he's got his artwork, his writing is on his mind and he just can't give her the time of day. After that, though, I'm trying to figure, like, who is she? Like I said, you said no name. We don't know what her job is or what she does other than try to fix up the house. Who is she? This is like kind of the baffling part where the film starts to, you start to realize like, wait, is she a person or does she stand in for something? Is she an allegorical entity?
She's on some kind of sort of internal journey because she's got those times where, you know, she is looking into the house and into the wall and she's got a perception, a sixth sense. She's feeling the house's heartbeat or if that's a fetus. And then we see there's a few sort of checkpoints throughout the movie where she'll come really close to the wall and then the camera, like the screen shows you like the in what it looks like inside and it looks like a heartbeat or a fetus. And then there's slow decay there. But largely her character is defined by what's happening around her.
Yeah, I was going to say, what I don't know if she is on a journey because she's kind of stagnant. The only thing is you're right. She does have this check-in, this power or whatever you want to call it, where she can check in on the house, which seems to symbolize like the status of their relationship in a way, like how's it doing or how's the house doing, which I think she sort of believes once she gets it up to perfection, everything will be good again, which, you know, it won't be.
Yeah, her understanding of their home and the rules that sort of apply, even though she pays applied to that home and who can come in, who can go, what they're going to do, are quite different from him. She offers lots of deference towards him. Like he's inviting people to come in and stay forever.
Please come in.
And she's like, yeah. She's like, I thought you would have asked me about that. He goes, oh, I didn't think you'd mind. It's like these people living in their house forever. I can't even have somebody coming over for a fucking beer after tennis or whatever, you know what I mean? Before my wife's getting on me.
All I'm trying to do is bring life into this house. Open the door to new people, new ideas.
He's inviting people to come in forever. What?
So what'd you think of am I saying it right? Javier Bardem?
Javier Bardem?
He's a great actor, but I love him.
He is a really good actor. He's a great stop and start actor. So he can conjure three or four or five different emotions in a really short period of time and seamlessly transfer between them. So there's one scene where he's at the door and there's so much adulation, and then really quickly he is like concerned, and then he gets really angry, and then he's very kind. Yeah. Like there's lots of different, there's a wheel of emotions that this cat goes through. He's a big dude, eh? And there's a presence about him, which if we read into any, even the Mother Earth or the God allegory or the devil allegory, like he's not a meek character. They needed someone that had presence on screen. He absolutely fits that bill. But there's like times when I feel like he's completely clueless to what's going on, which speaks to like a larger narrative of what he is and what his purpose in the movie is. Did you think his performance was good, Rob?
Oh, he's absolutely amazing. And I think he's playing the script perfectly. This character on paper must also be completely either uncaring of her or just like oblivious. And like, that's the part of the relationship the movie is their relationship. Like I'm trying to figure that part out the most, because it does feel like it's a movie that speaks to the sort of abusive, like casual abusive way men can treat their wives. Like this sort of like, you're an accessory to my life, instead of, you know, we're building something together. He just sort of assumes that what the things that he needs in his life are going to be fine for her to cope with, or she'll just have to cope with them because this is his life, and they're going to come into this house and be part of it. The one thing that about me, like, you know, we do the loop, the movie does a loop, right? And we'll get to that at the end, but there is a sort of looping feeling to the ending where it all begins again. So it makes me wonder, why is he in such an unfulfilled place at the beginning? Is that because time has gone on and the house has been slowly coming back up to its feet, and that whole time he's just been in depression for his old mother? And then, is this his fantasy we're living through? Like, that was the other question the movie begged of me. Like, are we not living in his fantasy, or is this happening to him as well?
I think that he knows that mother is replaceable. And I think we are living in his fantasy. We're living in his world. And at one point in the movie, she says something to him like, will it ever be enough? Will I ever be enough? And he goes, if it was, I wouldn't be able to do what I could do. So he is sort of operating under the premise that this mother, whatever mother, the people around him, it's never enough for him. So in that sense, I suppose it is his fantasy. Side note, I'd absolutely thought that there was a domestic element to this as well, in terms of, you know, unfulfilled marriage and couple, but it speaks to Javier Bardem's character, him being God, being, you know, the devil, something. To me, God seemingly made sense more with that, you know, looking at it through that religious lens. The adulation, the zealots, everybody that sort of comes around him, that look up to him, his understanding and his unfulfillment in the entire film, he is really he's the apex character of the movie, right? So it's his world. We're just living in it, Rob. But
exactly. So, it's kind of like a hardcore version of like The Giving Tree. You ever read that book to your kids? The Giving
Tree?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That's exactly like it.
It's like the rated R version of that book. You know, like the guy, like, first he sleeps under the tree, then he like wants to build
a
house.
Yeah, then he cuts off the branches and he makes a bench.
Yeah, and he makes like a fucking boat, and
he does enough though. That's the thing with the movie, which kind of keeps you invested on a human level, is that he does enough, not to her, but he shows enough with her, caring wise, affection, to keep you invested in the fact that it's a plausible relationship, right? And there's something there, like it genuinely does care for her. One of the great set of funny parts is, and like I just mentioned that, is when Ed Harris's character rolls up. And Rob, what happens then? This guy comes in out of the blue, and this is really sort of, you know, there's a knock on the door. He comes in late at night, and that sort of sets the picture on a little bit in a different direction.
Yeah, it's a very confusing moment because it seems like he, at first he's posing as if he got lost and he just, you know, ended up there. But then the two bond, they have drinks all night, but then Ed Harris is fucking sick. So every once in a while he just like hacks up a lung or like pukes and like, he just seems like he's falling apart. And then the next day we find out that Ed Harris is actually one of his biggest fans and he wanted to come see him. And then his wife shows up, who's like this fucking super hot looking Michelle Pfeiffer, by the way, who's just like controls the room as soon as she gets in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, she like runs the roost. And I guess we get the confession that Ed Harris wanted to meet him before he died. And there's your religious thing too. It's like he wanted to meet God one time before he gets either exiled or before he succumbs to death. But that, again, the parables don't kind of tie together as neatly as you'd like. So, yeah. And then the thing is for Jennifer Lawrence, she's just like, who's this guy? Why is he here? And then, you know, Michelle comes in, makes herself a ton of lemonade, fucks up the kitchen. She's getting drunk. She's asking about like their sex life. She's pulling her panties out of the laundry machine, being like, you got to change these up, honey. Like, it's not fucking invasive.
We're not right? going full yeah. bum.
It's so invasive, right? Like this woman's just like going through her garbage.
I didn't know they got the Home Alone basement for this for the basement scene, eh? They got the Home Alone set for this.
Shut up.
They got the Home Alone furnace. Like Ed Harris, I love him. From Westworld to History of Violence, like he's been in some cool films. He's kind of got that same kind of like arrogant look where he can kind of like shift between, you know, kind of vibage really quickly. And You're right. He's like hacking up a lung. He's like him fucking, he gets smokes. He's got the Rothmans going. And then she wakes up in the middle of the night and him is in the washroom with him. Ed Harris's character has got his head in the toilet. He's throwing up. He's clearly sick. He's dying of cancer or something. And him has his arm around him and looks back. And that is another sort of reinforcer for, you know, the God metaphor is that he's acting like father to his sick son. You know, just the way he had his arm over his shoulder and he was like, he was kind of caressing him and showing him affection and love. I thought that was absolutely important. That, and then they wake up the next morning and Jennifer Lawrence, like, she's like, she always has this like vapid look on her face. The whole time she's like, almost like she just sort of walked into it. Like, I don't know, like somebody just blew smoke in her face or something. I don't know. And then she goes, how are you? And he's like, oh, slept like a baby. No problem. He's like, we're going for a hike.
Bounce back.
You're going for a hike.
It's definitely like him. He is like sort of new age God or like, you know, like New Testament God. He's very like looking for love and wanting to respond with love.
Church of the universe.
But you're right. Jennifer Lawrence has very little to do sometimes. And it's kind of maybe a struggle of the film where she's like just staring or like has this upset look. And she's just sort of waiting for someone to ask her, are you okay with this? Or how do you feel, Jennifer? Dude. Nobody fucking bothers though, right?
So what was her step count in this film? She fucking walks around the movie all day. That's all she does, man.
It was blown up. Yeah.
15,000. Now, I just want to say one thing about Michelle Pfeiffer is like you said, she leaves the kitchen in such a fucking mess. Right from this point, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself, wow, these people are giving no fucking respect to this house. All right from the beginning, people are undermining the main message and the main theme. And the first thing that was presented to us as a movie watcher is that she's trying to fix this place and everyone else is trying to fuck it up. And that's that there's murder going on there. There's fucking lemons everywhere. He's throwing up in the washroom.
New guy's in the corner puking his guts out.
Like they're using it like a public space is what it kind of sort of feels like, the way they interact with him with mother and him and the way they treat the house. But
they're fucking with the door open.
Oh, everything, man. Like, it, you know, when they go up to the bedroom and they destroy the diamond that is clearly, like the guy said, a family heirloom. First thing is, oh, I'll go get it replaced, another one. So this is the first thing that kind of annoyed them. And then they come, and then obviously then a murder takes place in the actual house. Despite that, he's Javier Bardem's character has invited them back to say they can stay forever. Now, I just want to ask you, Rob, at what point are uninvited or our guests, what time do they pass the point of no return? Like, how long can guests stay in a home before you want them to go? My uncle has a great analogy. He says guests are like dirty laundry. They start to stink after 2 days. So have you ever had a situation where somebody has come over to your house and like is he just being polite and saying you can stay forever? And they're saying like, yeah, I'm actually going to fucking stay forever. Like,
I feel like I'm the guy who hangs around your house too long. I'm the guy who shows up and just won't leave.
No, that's going to go to Corey Augustine. If you invite that guy over, he is rolling in at 7:59 in the morning. He is, and he says you're going to stay over one night. He's not leaving until like 10:13 the next night. He's getting meals. I love Corey. But anybody out there, anyway, so I want the listeners to think about who is your one friend or your one family member that overstays their time in your house?
That's welcome.
What's happening here.
First, she catches Michelle and Ed fucking in the bedroom, which I think is hilarious because does she open the door? Is the door open? And they're just like fucking going at it.
Well, she's telling them they gotta leave. It's like Corey
Augustine. Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, she's trying to kick them out. And they're like, yeah, hold on. I just got to bust a nut here. Hold on. Like, and then they don't leave, of course. Or when they do, they come right back. And then the kids come. They fuck murder, death. So all of a sudden, the guy doesn't die on the floor. So him picks him up. They run him to the hospital. And she's like, don't leave me alone. He's like, I won't, whatever. You'll be fine. See ya. Peace. And the reason she's saying that is because the other brother ran away into the woods and could come back and does come back and leaves. And she's alone with him, which is super scary for her because she's like, there's a murderer near this house somewhere and I don't want to be left alone. Yeah, yeah, you'll be fine. Peace, bitch. And he like jumps in the car or you don't see the car. They just disappear. And then Michelle Pfeiffer and Ed Harris come back with like a ton of people because they're going to hold the funeral at their house. And people are just rolling in. They're handing off like a bowl of pasta. Here's a pasta salad. Thanks for having us. And she's like, who the fuck are you people? And also, she's still in her PJs. So Michelle Pfeiffer gives her this look like, what the fuck? And this is where my anxiety kicked in with my anxiety dreams I was talking about. Like, I was like, oh, yeah. Shit. She just like got called out for being in her PJs at the party. You know, they talk, the moment kind of shows that she's wearing like a white shirt that kind of like, you can kind of see her breasts a little bit. And yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer kind of gives her this look like, let's put something on, honey. And this is something that happened, like, ties into the toxicity of these people and the fandom that Jennifer Lawrence experienced this in real life, right? Like, she had her phone hacked and she had nude photos of herself leaked on the internet. And so this movie kind of points at that as the toxicity starts building around him and all these fans who are so obsessed with him and all these people that are coming to his house and they're like, thank you for your hospitality, and they're worshiping him and just being like, and who the fuck are you? And she's like, the person who owns this house? But nobody gives a shit. And this party keeps escalating. She keeps telling people, get off the sink, please. It's not buttressed yet. Like, it's going to fall. Yeah, yeah, whatever. And it starts getting crazier. People start disrespecting her more and more and more. Like, and this is where my anxiety is peaking. I could feel it coming up my spine. I'm just like, oh, this is awful.
Yeah, and that's what Jennifer Lawrence is like, yo, get the fuck out of my house. People are eating pasta. The one dude, the one old guy's like looking for a blanket. He's half naked trying to, you know, kick up on her like little kind of chair in her bed. So once again, it's now continually reinforcing the point of this is a communal space, which reinforces the idea and one of the main themes that there's a religious element to this, that the space is shared, that him,
yeah,
God, Jesus, whatever you want to say, is providing for them. And his love for his, and let's call them what they are, right? His disciples, that sort of is one of the themes that we start to pull out here, right?
They get to a point where they finally get people out. They finally have a moment together. They conceive a baby. She knows immediately. And like, as soon as the baby comes about, he starts writing again and like his creativity is flowing. And the moment before the baby is born, his publisher shows up because the book is ready to go and like they're going to make a ton of money and like everyone's excited about it. All of a sudden they're having press parties in the house and she's like trying to nest, right? Like she's building the baby's room. And now the crazy thing kicks all up again with all the fans are coming in and the press is coming in. And then it just sort of keeps escalating to the point that she's like, people keep trying to get into his room that's boarded up. People are in his room or her room. And then it turns into this war zone. And the press lady, who is played by one of my favorites, by the way, Kristen Wiig, yeah, is like good. Organizing the militia that's like shooting people, like bringing like, it gets crazy.
Yeah, and like this is where I actually shot in the head.
And this is where you said your anxiety kicked up. But this is where I actually started to like, oh, okay, now I can just kick my feet up and watch this craziness happen. I actually sort of stopped trying to follow or piece together the film. And I just decided to like lean back and be like, okay, let's just see what the hell's going to happen here. And of course, it gets so nuts until the point the baby is born. And she doesn't want him to take it out to show the disciples. And he wants to. But she's like, no. But he just sits there like a lion waiting for his male cub to be on watch by mother so he can eat it. You know, right. But he's not trying to kill it, but that's kind of the vibe you get here. He's staring at her, watching her fall asleep. And when she finally does, he takes the baby out to show all his fans and they take it for a fucking crowd surf until the baby gets its head cracked off a door frame. And then she's like chasing it, trying to get there. And by the time she gets there, it's a funeral for the baby and they're eating it.
You just went, you basically just went through, yeah, and then they're eating it. You went through the entire final scene. It's about the last 25 minutes of the film. I had written down about 20 bullet points of just crazy shit that I was watching in that as like a chronology of it, but you did a really good job of basically just bringing it all together. It is a crazy scene. Pick out maybe a couple of things really quickly.
Top five weird shit in this scene.
Okay, let's go top five weird shit in this scene. First off, there is a guy doing fucking chin-ups at the beginning.
Yeah.
Another, not kind of like weird shit, but one that was really telling was that the book that he writes that, you know, and he says, everybody gets something different from it. At one point, it's actually all those books and their white books. They're in like a straw basket and they're in a room that's all lit. And you see like a lot of shrine imagery. And then people are just grabbing like these books and going. Clearly, I think the intention is meant to be some kind of Bible, some biblical verse, something like that. So I thought that was maybe not weird, but okay. So then another weird thing. All of a sudden we've got whores in a cage. All of a sudden we've been transported into basically like an urban slum and you have like these pimps and they have these whores in this cage and they're trying to get out. They're looking to Jennifer Lawrence for help. And then one of them says something, something goyim. And then I looked that up and goyim is a Jewish word reference for a non-Jewish person. So now, as we talk about the connection to Jerusalem and Jesus Christ, it's just another sort of reinforcing aspect of this being religious. Okay. But then all of a sudden we're fucking top, let's go number three. We're in Call of Duty. All of a sudden the SWAT team rolls in and like covers her and then it gets blasted in the head. So this movie brought in modern day elements, but warring factions. Here's the thing, Rob. This movie brought in like warring factions of disciples and non-believers. And I think that is what we're seeing here is the juxtaposition and synthesis and battle between those who support him and those who don't. Okay.
Yeah, I think this is happening before she gives birth, isn't it? Because doesn't she get pepper sprayed when she's still pregnant? And I was like, wow, this movie's fucking crazy. This pregnant lady getting blasted pepper spray in the face.
Yeah, I think maybe if it was before she gave birth, but it's all sort of in the same
It all keeps rolling. Yeah.
Okay, so then, and then I was going to go top. You already mentioned it. Like, the baby is body surfing. Yeah. They're like, oh, and then you've got the one dude. So all of a sudden, through no sort of assessment criteria, you have a deputy Jesus guy. not the publicist, but you've got the one dude that's got
kind of got like a priest or a pope or whatever.
Yeah, and then now he's putting like football or Javier Bardem, and he's got something that the deputy dude has like some black like paint on his face, and now Javier Bardem is putting like football eye black on all of his disciples, mm-hmm. and they're coming in, and he's almost, you know, one of the things when we get to that point, it was kind of maybe, I don't know, I think we probably have top eight crazy shits, but another one is how just orgasmic everybody is, especially Javier Bardem's character. He's like giddy.
Oh yeah, he's loving this.
Number five, should be number one, is at some point, we're transported back to the opening scene of fucking Blade. And the techno music is bumping, and there's like a fucking party going on in like right adjacent to the kitchen. And I'm thinking to myself, is this guy just basically just putting everything in? Because at this point, Rob, at this point in the movie, anything can mean anything. Like the Sharpie that I'm using right now can be a metaphor for a fucking lightsaber. Like, you know what I mean? It's
yeah, but I think it's also like it's humanity, like at its best and worst, at its worst here. Like just like overindulging, over like taking advantage of the space, like this like breakthrough, like you said, orgasmic energy just like flowing. And we should probably PSA here, by the way, people who don't have babies, you can't crowd surf a baby. I just want to let you know that they have very weak necks. So crowd surfing a baby, a terrible, terrible fucking idea.
Anyway. Can I just tell the listeners a quick story? Really quick story. Okay, friend of the pod, my man, Michael Yokota. So we go to our first concert, 1993, Violent Femmes, Green Day. Rob, you were there, weren't you?
No, I didn't see
that. Die Toten Hosen? Anyways, we got a crowd surfing story. Friend of the pod, Michael Yokota, he was in the first Jogcast. We've had him on before. So he decides, he pulled like, I don't want to make light of in this movie, a baby breaking their neck when they're crowd surfing, but Yik had one of those experiences. First song of the first band, opening band, there's like fucking seven people in the mosh pit. Okay. It's very small. Like nobody's even there yet. And Yik's just so excited to be at a concert. He's got his plaid shirt on. So he's like, yo, put me up. He gets put up instantaneously. He gets elbowed in the nose. Blood is gushing all over the floor. And his concert experience was cut short by crowd surfing and getting into it too much. So I want to let Mike Yokota know that, you know, we got our way to the health and safety office on that day. and just let you know, I'm thinking about you, man.
Yeah, it sounds like exactly what happens in this movie. Like shit just goes out of control. And to the point that Jennifer Lawrence, she lost her baby. Now she's like, fuck you. Fuck all you people. I'm going down to the basement. Oh, yeah. Where she's already found, like she, earlier in the film, she cracked a light. The light exploded blood, and the blood outlined like a square, like a rectangle, like a doorway that now that she can open, we realize it's like, it's almost like a metaphor for like a door to hell or something, but there's an oil something in there, some frogs hop out, and she like sets it on fire because it's like, this is how the house burned down the first time probably, right? Boom, blows up the house. Everybody's dead except him, who is completely unfazed, doesn't get burned. This is where we realize it's some sort of supernatural or godlike figure, and he comes over and he's like, oh baby, you know, I'm sorry, and he lays her down. She's like, what else do you want from me? Like, seriously, why aren't I even fucking dead? Like, please let me die. He's like, I just need one more thing, baby, just one more thing I need from you, who's totally like hunchback in Notre Dame, covered in flames now, like just, she looks like hell, right? He pulls out of her chest or her stomach another piece of coal as she dies completely. She's coal, and he crushes it into a diamond like Superman. And then he puts the diamond back on his bookshelf. And I was wondering, Jimmy, did you think it weird that they stole the ending of Krampus for this film?
Where they have like the snow globe and everything. Yeah, it's like he's basically Krampus, and everybody's just kind of living in his world and stuff. No, but I thought that was a good take. Krampus 2.
Yeah.
Mother.
Krampus 2. Mother 2. Krampus 2. Yeah, it turns out it's a loop, and then another mother wakes up with the exact identical scene as the first scene of the movie, a different woman now in his bed who wakes up the exact same way, and mother has been, you know, a new mother is here now, and we're back in the same house, and I guess it's like rinse and repeat.
Yeah, and you know what, we talked about the Mother Earth allegory, that's another strong theme. You could make the case that you know, that's another thing. This house is like a picture perfect house. It's very symmetrical. The beginning of time, perhaps as a metaphor for the world, the Garden of Eden, there's no roads. All it is landscape around. And there is, there's a couple of shots, overhead shots, where you see that it's sort of like barren purgatory-ish land around this sort of idyllic area. And then the idea that Mother Earth, you know, she comes in different iterations, different forms. She can be not destroyed. Now, she can be injured, she can be killed, but she reinvents herself. She'll always be sort of the supreme being. And then of the house, which is the earth and the world in which we live in. You can go online and look at this. I didn't find the Mother Earth allegory that interesting because I found other aspects of the film to dive into to the religious element, the domestic element, and just the idea of like fan toxicity, I thought was kind of cool. But the Mother Earth allegory is there. And I just thought funny just how like we're just, you know, we're fucking up the earth. Everybody knows it, and that they're fucking up her house. You know what I mean? You draw a simple connection there. Do you see anything else in that earth allegory?
Yeah, of course. She's used. She's just used. She has to keep giving. Nobody gives back to her. Nobody says, hey, what can we do to heal her, make her better? Like, it's all just take. And that's very much how we approach our existence here on Earth, is like Earth is there for the taking. Yeah, no, the allegory is pretty easy in that way, but I think it's a pretty elaborate way of getting to that allegory, don't you think? I think the film is a film first.
I actually thought it was really interesting about the idea of like isolation and, you know, toxic fandom and how we aggrandize people for different reasons, athletes, writers, actresses, political figures, and how that forces them into these really insecure, unstable states, right? And it makes them really pull away from the rest of society. And I don't want to say like be in a depressive state, but be in like a reclusive state and only gaining their true self is through adulation. And I think I've never been famous. Like, I know we're kind of famous with the Jogcast, but we're not like really
famous. Yeah. Yeah.
100%. Like, we're not really famous. Me and you can still go to the grocery store. You know, we're not.
I get accosted sometimes, but you know, I try to be polite to everybody.
You're in Montreal, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we haven't really gotten, we're not doing French language Jogcast. So you're safe. But me, you know, anyways, in this movie, if you look through it through that lens, he is whole. He is full. He is himself when he is being adored. And I think that's problematic.
I think it does tie back to the God metaphor, though, too, because the question is kind of like, if you were a God, you would just make another Earth, which is what he does. Yeah. And so if that's his relationship to Earth, that you're just a vessel that which I create people to adore me on, like, that's why he doesn't really give a shit about her. She's just the boat. You know, she's just the yacht that the yacht party is going to take place on.
I'm on a boat. I'm on a boat. Everybody look at me because I'm sailing on a boat.
You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't really give a shit about the boat itself. He just wants the party people who are going to be on the boat.
I'm on a boat and it's going fast and I got an nautical theme. Pass me the Afghan.
And that's what he gets off on. He needs that energy, people worshiping him, adoring his creation. But Earth is not his gem. Like, they are his gems, really. Like, he doesn't give a shit about the planet so much as he cares about who's on it. So, I don't know. I thought that was an interesting – that's kind of the way I look at that and wrap those two things together. Jamie, we've really, like, dug into this. Should we get to the rating now on this film?
Yeah, Rob, that sounds good. I just want to go through my top 5 to 12 things that I'm left questioning.
12 things? Dude, we got 5 minutes here. Let's go.
That I'm left to question about. Okay, first thing, yellow potion. What does it mean? Not the yellow potion, the yellow Alka-Seltzer she's having. What is it?
I don't know. It's like an anti-anxiety remedy, isn't it? I don't know. She seems to calm down when she
takes
it.
It's funny. I didn't look that through any kind of metaphorical, symbolistic lens. I just thought, you know, she just needs something to calm her stomach. Lemonade is a spiritual drink. Apparently lemons were flourished in the Garden of Eden and like were, I don't know, lemons grew in religious zones.
yeah, go on.
So I thought that was an interesting choice because it could have been cranberry juice, could have been Diet Pepsi, but it wasn't, Rob. It was lemonade. Also, fetus heart in the toilet. I'd be calling maintenance on that Rob, what was that fetus in the heart in the toilet?
I'm a landlord. If my tenants don't, should be calling me if they see shit like that. Trust me, we'll take care of that.
You got to be asking for extra rent money on that one. And then lastly, right? The vagina in the floor. What is that?
Yeah, somebody steps in it at one point too.
Somebody steps in it and it gets bigger. It's interesting that the vagina in the floor is, as it gets bigger, her vision in the heart, in like the fetus or heart in the wall decays. So I wonder if that is symbolistic of her chest, because him goes into her chest to pull out the coal, which eventually turns into the diamond. I wonder if just like,
oh,
life,
it's her heart. If, isn't that what he pulls out? It's her heart.
Yeah. I just feel that, like it's symbolistic of once we are born, we begin to die. And we sort of see that happening in the movie. I don't know. I think they need a pet. They see.
Like that, but yeah, their relationship might have hung together a lot longer. They just had a dog.
They need a dog. But okay, we've gone through it, had a good chat on it. You're right. Let's review and rate the film.
I like this movie a lot because I thought it was an artistic, like, opus. Like it challenges you. It is an experience. It's not so much a narrative film. I definitely am giving people the caveat, like, hey, don't go into this expecting a nice and tidy story. Expect to come out asking yourself a lot of questions, but also go into it and watch it as a film. Like, what did they do to make this? How did they make this? It feels very much like theater at times because they never leave that one space and she's like wandering room to room. So it does feel like a theater production sometimes. And then how that explodes into that last 30 minutes where things just go off the wall is like, it's incredible. Like I think it's just an achievement in certain to like pull off that sort of immersion. It does require you to sort of like let go, which is hard because this film is constantly making you anxiety ridden and like tense up. So to like just relax and watch it, it's hard. But I like that. I think that's a challenge and I think that should be commended. I mean, the one question is there anything to this when you peel away all these layers of all this symbology, you know, what do you get when you pull it all away? And again, like even Javier Bardem says it in the film where he's like talking about his own book, like everybody gets something different from it. And in a way, that's what the director's doing here. He's just like, hey, man, you take what you want from this film. Like, it's up to you. I'm not going to tell you what it's about, which is that a cop out or is that like just like a exercise in how we study and think about art making? So I'm going to give it, no, I think it's a difficult question and I'm not going to try to answer it because it's too wide and too big. But as someone who likes to make creative things, I do think that's a question that's hard to, like, that's good to put out there. I'm going to give it 4 footsteps. I'm taking off a footstep because I think it is somewhat inaccessible, as you alluded to earlier. It's going to challenge people and some people are just going to throw up their arms and walk away and be mad about it. But I think for those of us who just like are able to chill, sit and watch it, it's worth the experience of sitting through it.
Good review. Rob, I'm going to start my review with a recommendation that we recast Mother. And in the role of Javier Bardem as him, everybody gets something different from it. I say we put in the one, the only, Paul Cerrone.
Don't make me out a monster. I didn't eat the Captain Mateo.
He was he worked in the priesthood in Paraguay. I think that.
Could you imagine someone made like a B movie version of this film? Like just like a shitty version? Like let's make a cheap, stupid version of that film. What would it look like?
Oh my God. Can we fucking do that? Can that be our first movie? And let's put it on a boat. Going down the Lake Huron.
Oh, man.
Could you just transplant the Anaconda cast into this film? It'd be fucking great. Here's the thing. The movie I watched the first time and I found myself, my hands were clenched tight. Second time, I just let go and I just sort of enjoyed the experience. Second time I watched it, I enjoyed it much more because the first half of the film, watching it the first time, I was bored because I was trying so hard to figure out what the story was. And then the second time, knowing what I knew because I'd gone through the film, I just sort of relaxed. It was hard to do the first time. In fact, I couldn't do it. So when I watched it the second time and then, you know, subsequent times after that, because there was parts that I really enjoyed, I found that circling back to what you said at the beginning of our podcast is that the experience electrified me. I enjoyed it. It stimulated me. I like to think about movies and we have a podcast about horror films, although this is not a horror film. And we like to talk about them. We like to break them down. So for me, my perspective is such that I enjoy the – what? I don't know what this is. It's a psychological – I don't think so. It's a psychological journey. I don't know. You could say like this is a religious drama. Like I don't know what you could call it. The point is that the activity itself, which I believe in this kind of movie, there's an activity embedded. There's a decoding activity that is interesting and exciting for some people. For me, it was good. One of my critiques is some, you know, and this movie is not going to be for them. But some people will find the overlayering of themes and metaphors and symbolism and just the way the movie is sort of arrogant and self-serving. Now, I don't see it that way, but I know that that is how some people will see it. And that's fine. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. From our perspective, I started in the air of disbelief and then I've worked my way over to really like enjoying and appreciating the film for what it is. Like the ending scene itself is crazy. Like there's a guy, it's like from Kingdom of Heaven when they march out to face the Persian army and the guy's holding like the big flags and staffs. Like that shit's going on in her sitting room. You know what I mean? Right at the end of the film. So it's an assault on the senses. You know what I mean? Like it very much is. And for me, that's fantastic. So I'm not even talking about horror. I'm not even talking about performances. I'm talking about just the way the material is being presented and the film itself. I think it was really good. And for me personally, I'd like a few more scares. I think I would have done a little bit more of like on the horror element because there's absolutely opportunity to build in dread. But this is not the film. This is not the film that he was trying to make. So I would be remiss if I gave this anything lower than a 3 out of 5 footsteps. And I probably would just, you know, be kind of slapping it if I gave this anything over 4.5 out of 5. So I'm going to come in at 3 footsteps and a first ever for the Running Scared pod.
Oh, no.
One and a half toes. So that leaves me at 3 footsteps and then 3/4 of a foot. So 3.75 footsteps out of 5.
Wow. Okay. That's a unique way to do it. Might as well for a unique film like this one. Why is there an exclamation point at the end of the movie, by the way? The title. Mother! Why is it mother? We've been saying it wrong the whole time.
Good point. Why is there an exclamation point? I don't know. Rob, really quickly, 30 seconds. What do we got going on? You want to do the links? You want to do the update? You want to go on what's going on with the subscription box down at 6 a.m.? We got another Jodcast. What do we want to talk about real quick?
Okay, new Jodcast. We've already promoted that. You know it's out there. Patreon has been restructured. Cheaper, easier to enter. Be really helpful if you join. Plus, you get access to our Jodcast. 6 a.m. run, we are handing out a flyer, which basically is a promo to get a look at Hell and Hamilton for free. That is already for free on Patreon, by the way, for all of you out there. So it's not just for them, but it is something we're doing with them just to do a little promo, cross promotion. And of course, you can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. And Jamie is branched into TikTok. We haven't dived in too hard yet, but we are looking at it, trying to figure it out. What a space that is. Anything else, James? Or I think that wraps it up.
No, that sounds good. I enjoyed this, Rob. This was fun. Let's get on doing the next movie quickly. I'm probably going to send out a poll. I want to do something fucking scary. So if you're listening to this and you have a recommendation for a really scary film, send us a quick email, therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear it. Otherwise, Rob and I are just going to probably throw a poll out and pick something, get it done. Rob, it has been great speaking with you today. I wish you all the best in Quebecico. And I look forward to seeing you in person at some point in the coming days and weeks. And I wish you good luck in collecting donations for Terry Fox.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that. Yeah. Get those wallets open, people. Let's help out some cancer research. All right. Thank you. This has been fun. And see you next time on Running Scared. The Running Scared podcast is written and produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts. This episode edited by Robert Lendrum. Find us on social media and tune in next time for another movie review on Running Scared.
You give and you give and you give. It's just never enough.